Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining me. We've got some wonderful things to discuss. Second hour today, I'm going to go to a topic that I think is underutilized in Catholic circles. It's the idea of the temple. I mean, for the Hebrew people, the temple was the center of the universe, quite literally. Everything revolved around the temple. God revealed himself through the temple, revealed himself through the priesthood, through the covenants. Dr. Stephen Smith joins us to take us on a deep dive into the Old and the New Testaments, exploring the priesthood, exploring the covenant, but exploring the function of the temple in both the Old and the New. And, of course, what is Jesus' relationship to the temple? Well, he becomes, of course, the new temple. But it's incredible work of biblical theology. So Steve's going to join us second hour. Now, in this first hour, I'm going to talk a little bit about jobs and a little bit of autobiography here, a little bit of memoir about how I became aware of a particular job shaping me in ways, not in immoral or unethical ways, but just shaping me in terms of emphasis in ways that I didn't think were really was God's will for my own life and spiritual formation, and how that actually was a I had a good sense of making a change, and by the grace of God, I did. But it's a good story. I want to share that with you. We're also going to talk about the late Father Paul Mankowski, one of the most brilliant writers I've ever read. Our friend George Weigel will be joining us. For Ignatius Press, George went ahead, and upon the death of Father Mankowski, George went ahead and collected various essays of his, wrote an introduction, and also gave us some insight into why the last years of Father Paul Mankowski's lives, he didn't do much writing. This is not a very happy story about that. But we'll look at the life and the mighty pen of Father Paul Mankowski with George Weigel. But first, let's get some headlines. Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. You've probably seen those hilarious pictures of people who grow to look like their dogs, right? And it's a cliche that old married couples come to resemble each other over the decades. Not sure how true that is, but it's a cliche anyways. I am convinced, however, that it's true for our jobs. We actually do come to be shaped, at least interiorly, by the jobs we hold and the responsibilities we shoulder in those jobs. And that means that we should always ask how our jobs are shaping us. We talk about this in terms of our entertainment, right? Okay. We should talk about it in terms of our jobs as well. Are they shaping us in a way that enable us to love more deeply, to serve more broadly? I know that the jobs I've held over the years have shaped me and reinforced certain patterns of thought within me. For instance, I spent a summer selling roofing and siding door to door. Yes, I did. In towns around Kalamazoo and Battle Creek in Michigan. I'm not even sure if they do much door to door selling anymore, but back then it was common enough. And to this day, if I'm walking through a residential neighborhood, I glance up at the roofs to see if the shingles look ragged or if the keyway spacing looks right. And this, the way that jobs shape you, and in my case, me, became crystal clear to me after 10 years of managing retail bookstores. I'll tell you the story on this. Shortly after my adult conversion to Christ, when I was still a student at Michigan State, I was given one afternoon an incredibly strong sense of mission and call. And I knew I would spend my life sharing the gospel and the truths of the Christian faith. It wasn't much more specific than that. It wasn't that I felt called to the pastorate or into foreign missions or to manage some parachurch ministry, just that I would spend my life sharing the gospel and the truths of the Christian faith. But after I graduated, married Sally, and had no success at all as a freelance writer, two friends of mine offered to train me to manage the Logos Christian bookstore that they co-owned in East Lansing. And they spent months training me in retail management and merchandising, and it was a gift. It equipped me for my work in other bookstores for the next 10 years after. And this comported nicely with my sense of mission to disseminate the truths of the Christian faith. I had lots of friends who were going to seminary at the time, but it wasn't for me. This is what I had immediately, the task had been put in front of me to manage these stores. Well, after they sold their store in East Lansing, my wife Sally and I moved to the Detroit area to manage another Logos bookstore. And after 2 years or so, we ended up acquiring 10 bookstores that needed to be completely redesigned and relaunched with a new corporate identity. Eden Books was the name. And I didn't find any intrinsic conflict between my calling to spread the truth of the faith and my work in retail management. I was carrying out the mission of spreading the faith. We put a lot of money and time in creating a retail floor space that had plenty of room for people to sit, prayer, the fellowship, conversation, coffee, browsing, reading. We bought in all new signage, reorganized all the book categories, all the fixture and furniture changed. And we were a very high-touch retail operation, even as we worked at that time with the best inventory control software that was in our industry. We treated our customers, we were all trained to treat our customers as though they were members of the body of Christ, brothers and sisters, before they were customers. And thankfully, the staff I had there loved the new vision for the stores. And so they were trained in listening to the wants and needs of customers. And they would recommend books in a way that a doctor would prescribe medicine, right? So customers, again, became friends. It was very familial. And we did our best to understand business as ministry and serving others. And we did fine financially. Now, obviously, a business must operate in the black or it will collapse. So it was important to do the work of retail, diligently control expenses, renegotiate leases when you can, keep clean inventory, look at turnover of the inventory. But the owner of the stores and myself as the general manager saw eye to eye on the absolute necessity of the stores being outposts for ministry and service for those who came into the stores. We didn't just want to be selling material. We wanted to be creating a much more a ministerial outpost, so to speak. Well, I continued to do the work of an evangelist in my personal relationships and with, new people I would meet. And on occasion, I'd be asked to conduct Bible studies or to speak on apologetics at local churches. But the sweat of my brow, that was running bookstores. That was my task. And then an incident occurred that over years made me realize that I had neglected an important aspect of retailing. A young man with whom I'd spent untold hours helping out with Bible study, praying with, just being a listening ear, came into our store in Taylor, Michigan, one Friday afternoon. He was carrying Bob Dylan's Slow Train Coming album. Now, this was the first of a few explicitly Christian albums that Dylan recorded in the late 70s and early 80s. We carried the album in our store at the standard retail price, but he was flush with enthusiasm because he had just purchased it for a dollar cheaper at a large retail outlet just down the street from us. A place similar to what Target's is today. Now, a buck wasn't a big deal from my perspective. But from his perspective as a customer, it was enough for him to leave us behind and shop elsewhere, in spite of the amount of time lavished on him and his girlfriend as they hung around our stores. And, I realized that customer loyalty that I had presumed existed wasn't really strong enough to withstand a dollar discount. At the time, I experienced it as a bit of betrayal. But look, I was young. I finally accepted the fact that for most people, saving a buck was decisive. They didn't mean me any harm by this, but they would shop where they could save money. And my emphasis on service and ministry and the amount of time and money invested in training our staff and designing our retail space, that would always be subordinate to their interest in saving money. No matter how much I wish it was different, when we were in my stores, our relationship was first of all customer and merchant, not brother and sister. Again, there's nothing immoral about that, and I get frustrated when I hear so-called social justice Catholics look at business ownership or management as somehow tainted. I never felt that way, then or now. Business is a form of ministry. It is a form of service. But I did realize that if I were to excel in my job as a retail manager, I needed to spend more time really focusing on buying and selling with an eye to saving my customers a few extra dollars. And that meant working more effectively with publishers and distributors to buy in greater volume, get them to pay the shipping costs, make sure that our Christmas inventory was nailed down in July because that was when wholesale discounts were the greatest. I was already doing much of that, but it wasn't the priority that it would need to be in the future. The reason I knew this is because a friendly acquaintance of mine, not quite a friend, but a friendly acquaintance of mine, was the general manager of a competing chain of stores. And we talked, you know, now and then, and we often compared notes about publishers and authors and trends, different Christian events. And he loved the challenge of buying and selling, of negotiating and renegotiating, of wheeling and dealing, squeezing an extra percent off the standard discount. Now, I would feel the satisfaction that comes from a job well done, but he was energized by it, and it summoned up all his creative juices at trade shows. I'd watch him visiting and tangling with all the major publishers. He came prepared with a few alternate strategies to get what he wanted and reduce his cost of goods by a percent or even two, and that's significant. He was in his glory doing that. I wasn't. I finally realized that to really be all in on this project, I would have to set aside the more ministerial side of my life and focus on being a better steward of all these retail resources. Now, both things were acceptable, but I felt in my bones that for me to stay in the retail world would have shaped me in ways that didn't feel quite right, given who I understood myself to be at that time. I went off on a personal retreat in July of 1985. This is when this was becoming exceptionally clear to me. And I told the Lord that if I still felt this way after Christmas, I would have to take that as a signal that it was time to find new work that was somehow better suited to who He had created me to be. Well, in the following October, just a few months later, a friend of mine called who was resigning his pastorate, and he asked me if I would consider candidating to pastor the small church that he was pastoring and I had occasionally taught at and had done some street evangelization with over many years. And it was a surprise to me, but after the usual consultation with, of course, Sally and then close friends in the Lord, I said, yeah. Well, the congregation voted in December, and after Christmas, I began pastoring this church. My work there led to an offer to try out talk radio a year later, and eventually my responsibility as a pastor forced me to reconsider Jesus' will for his church. And that eventually led me, you know, into full communion with the Catholic Church. You know, what we do in our jobs will shape us. I still look at roofs, and I still wonder about books and pricing and publishing and discounting. It has never left me. But it would have been a mistake for me to have merely settled for, you know, a well-done job when I actually sensed that Christ was signaling a different way, more in keeping with who He had created and redeemed me to be. I look back, and I'm very grateful for what back then and today seemed like pretty clear guidance. Had I not been honest with myself and considered first in thought, then in prayer, then in consultation with my spouse, then with close friends, and then by asking fellow Christians to confirm my gifts and calling that I believed I had received, then my life would have been very different for me and for my family, for certain. And I would have been deprived of the work that I've been able to do with Ave Maria, with all the outstanding men and women at EWTN, and lastly, with all of you who have given me this platform. So instead of talking about Black Friday today, I'm going to continue to bask in the spirit of Thanksgiving, thanking God, my friends at Ave Maria and EWTN, and you for giving me such an outstanding number of years. Thank you. And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. The late Jesuit Father Paul Mankowski was brilliant, but he wrote with such insight and humor. And I just say from my own experience with him, and I did not read much of him, but when I was just returning to the Catholic Church in 1992, I came across an essay of his in First Things called What I Saw at the American Academy of Religion, which had me in tears. It is rare to find somebody with a mastery of intellectual and academic matters write with such searing insight into the foibles of university professors. With me right now, though, to talk over the larger picture of Father Mankowski's life, is George Weigel. George, of course, is Distinguished Senior Fellow and William E. Simon Chair in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's the author of many books, as you know, including Witness to Hope, The Next Pope, which we need to actually do another interview on, and Evangelical Catholicism. He is the editor and also provided an outstanding introduction to this new book, Jesuit at Large, Essays and Reviews by Paul V. Mankowski, S.J. George, great to have you here. Thanks.
Thank you, Al. I don't know whether you could hear me laughing in the background when you mentioned what I saw at the American Academy of Religion, which is, I think, one of the five most brilliant and arguably funniest articles that First Things has published in 30-plus years.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm very, very happy that we've managed to bring that up from the file cabinet and put it in this book.
Yes, yes.
It's one of many, many brilliant, scintillating, witty pieces by one of the most remarkable men I have ever met, whom I was privileged to call a friend for over 30 years.
Yeah. I never met him, never had a chance to interview him. And in fact, it occurred to me over the years when I didn't see more material from him. I wondered, what happened to him? This guy was great. And there was a period of time in which he was silenced, apparently. Is that right?
Yeah. There was a period of time when he was not allowed to publish by his religious superiors. Fortunately, that ban was lifted after some time. But it was a tragedy because this was one of the great minds and pens in the Catholic Church,
yep,
in the English-speaking world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like saying, okay, Chesterton, you can't write anything for
right,
10 years.
Right, right.
Or okay, Ronald Knox, you can't write anything for 10 years.
Right.
It's a loss, but I think the material that's collected in Jesuit at Large, which I think are Father Mankowski's major essays and reviews, both going back to the 90s and in more recent years when this ban was lifted by a more discerning superior, if I may use the Jesuit term, really will stand the test of time.
Yeah.
As I said in my own column on the book last week, Paul Mankowski really had no peer as a book reviewer. I mean, you could have given him anything from Julia Child's latest cookbook to Norman Mailer's latest dumb novel to a Ugaritic dictionary.
Right, right.
To the collected works of Evil and War. And, I mean, he just do a brilliant job on it.
Yeah.
He was one of the most wide-ranging minds that I think I've ever met. And yet, absolutely without what our British friends would call side. He was a genuinely ascetic man. He had no pretensions. He lived a rigorously ascetical life. And yet he was one of the funniest people I have ever met. He may be the funniest person I've ever met. I have emails from him dating back 30 years that I have saved because when I'm in the slough of despond, all I have to do is pull one of them out and read it. And I'm laughing my head off.
Yeah. He was a tough guy too, right? He was a former boxer, did some boxing, and he never lost his love for, kind of working class Catholicism, blue collar Catholicism, whatever you want to call it.
That's what he grew up in South Bend, Indiana, in the days when that was still an industrial town.
I mean, right.
It was the home of Studebaker and a lot of machine tooling stuff and automobile supply places. And that's what his dad was. His dad worked in one of those, I think, Bendix plant. The smartest kid in South Bend, Indiana, never looked down his nose at the neighborhood and the people that he grew up in.
Yeah.
He helped put himself through the University of Chicago by working in a steel mill during the summer. When he was doing a degree at Oxford, he ran into the man who would become in 2013 the Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott, who was over there on a Rhodes Scholarship. And Paul became Tony Abbott's sparring partner. for all of that, I mean, a remarkable spiritual director, a truly gentle soul in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, he could be absolutely fierce in denouncing what he thought was hypocrisy or apostasy or stupidity, but he was a real pastor when it came to helping people through the messes that we all make in our lives.
Sure.
Quite remarkable personality. I still can't quite believe that he's dead. This Paul died on September 3rd of last year.
Just last year, yeah. What were the circumstances
still,
for that?
He had said mass for a group of contemplative nuns. This is at the height of plague time, and he was, helping out getting the sacraments to people who were having a tough time accessing the sacraments. And he went to the dentist's office, and the dentist put him in the chair and went out to wash his hands or whatever. And when he came back, Paul was slumped over.
Huh.
And the EMT people thought it was a heart attack. Turned out it was a burst cerebral aneurysm.
Okay.
66 years old, far too young.
Far too young, yeah.
And to this day, there are, something will happen, or I'll run into something funny, or ludicrous, or whatever. And my immediate instinct is I'll call Paul about that.
Wow.
I'll send him an email about that.
Yeah.
But shortly after his death, I couldn't attend the funeral because of travel and COVID and all that.
Sure.
But the thought occurred to me, this guy deserves to be anthologized.
Right.
So so I called up my good friend Mark Brumley at Ignatius Press and said, I'm willing to take this on if you guys are willing to do it. And, of course, Father Minkowski was a great friend of Father Fessio,
right.
The founder of Ignatius Press. So they were all in, and, you know, we got this put together, and then I had said to Mark, I will write a substantial introduction to this that, that you know, lays out this guy's life and his significance and whatnot. So that's the book.
Yeah, and it's got great essays in it, book reviews, and also an appendix, which we'll go into. Because I'll wait until the next segment before we go into any of the details surrounding why he was silenced. But I think that it was in your book that I read that might have been your introduction, in fact, that he was not bitter. He might have been frustrated, but he wasn't bitter, and he could still counsel a young man with cautions to consider becoming a Jesuit.
Yeah, that's a letter I quote rather extensively in the introduction from a letter that Father Minkowski had sent to a young man who was trying to figure out what he should do with his life, and he was quite blunt in his candid, I should say,
yeah,
about his concerns about the present state of the society. But, you know, then said, if I had to do it all over again, I'd do it all over again.
Right.
So, no, he was not at all bitter. I think it's probably more true to say that some of his brethren were embittered toward him.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that at the end of his life, in the last half dozen years or more, he had superiors who appreciated his gifts, turned him loose again, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very fulfilling ministry at the Lumen Christi Institute
in Chicago.
Chicago,
yep. Okay.
Which just lost its founding director, Tom Levergood.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, Thomas died last month, I think.
How old was Tom?
Early, late 50s.
Yeah,
early 60s.
What I thought. He was young too.
Very, yeah, very sad business. So I think at the end, Paul and the society had reached a kind of modus vivendi that was more comfortable for everyone than it had been perhaps 20 years before.
Yeah, yeah.
I ran into a very senior member of the Jesuit leadership, whom I won't name, here in Washington about 3 years ago at a mass at St. Matthew's Cathedral. And I thanked him after the mass for what he had done for Paul Minkowski over the years, and he said to me, I wish I were as good a priest as Paul Minkowski.
Wow. George, hold it there. We need to take a break. We'll come back and continue the conversation. It's a wonderful collection of essays and reviews called Jesuit at Large. The essays and reviews of the late Father Paul Minkowski, edited by George Weigel. And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. My guest, George Weigel, edited and provided an introduction to this wonderful collection of essays and reviews by the late Father Paul Minkowski, who left this world last fall, or early fall. And he, one of the things, a number of friends of mine have mentioned Father Minkowski over the years, and the word that they always bring up is brilliant. Second, they bring up humor or wit. And the third thing is they say strong. He could speak without ambiguity. In fact, that's one of the things that I kind of pick up from what you wrote too, George, and the essays that are here. This is not a man who had much patience with studied ambiguity.
At the time of Father Minkowski's death, and I think I repeated this line in my introduction, I said he was not a man of the subjunctive. And I wasn't trying to be clever. I just think that's the truth. I mean, he was a very indicative personality. And he thought that there was an awful lot of, if you will, subjunctivitis in the church, mm-hmm. and that this was harmful. It was harmful to preaching the gospel. It was harmful to explaining why the church teaches what it teaches about what makes for righteous living. If his shade will forgive me for using a 60s phrase here, he told it like it was. And that, of course, made some people very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But he remained true to what he understood to be the vocation to which he was completely unexpectedly called. I mean, I go through this in the introduction to the book. He was finishing the University of Chicago as an undergraduate, you know, stellar record. Had a young lady with whom he was having a very close friendship, perhaps pointing towards marriage. Anticipated going on to graduate studies in classical languages and history. And then just like a bolt out of the blue came this idea to him, you are to be a Jesuit.
Wow.
And a priest. And as he tells it, and I record in the introduction, he fought this for some time and finally said, okay, you win. And then there's this typically hilarious Menkowski story where he didn't know any Jesuits. So he looks this up in a directory, and he finds something called the Jesuit Vocation Office, which he said I correctly and quickly discerned, or quickly and correctly discerned, was a fundraising operation. And asked the lady who answered the phone, who does he talk to about becoming a Jesuit? And she panics and starts running. He said she ran away from the phone, telling me to hold on as if she were afraid I might become a Dominican.
That's great.
And, so it was, this was a vocation that Paul accepted as, you know, a divine call. And he thought that once he had made that commitment, he was all in.
Right.
But being all in, according to the terms in which he understood the vows of religion, poverty, chastity, and obedience, made for some uncomfortable times.
Yeah.
A friend of mine with whom he studied Italian in Rome when he was deployed to the Pontifical Biblical Institute to teach there. And by the way, he learned Italian in 6 weeks. He got there, got an Italian tutor, and was lecturing in Italian in 6 weeks.
Wow.
But my friend, Monsignor Chris Nolte in New Orleans, who had the same tutor, said that the tutor had said to him that Il Padre Menkowski è un vero ascetico, a true ascetic.
Mm.
And he really lived that. I mean, he was a scholar without a personal library.
That's strange.
But,
yeah.
You know, public and academic libraries were enough for him.
Wow.
If you would take him out to dinner, or as we used to hang out at a pizza place off the Campo dei Fiori in Rome that Father Menkowski used to call Parcells because the owner looked like Bill Parcells, the old coach of the New York Giants. But and I would obviously pick up the tab, and then he would go back to the Biblicum and write a check to the Missionaries of Charity for whatever his portion of the tab would have been.
Wow.
When he was finally allowed to make final vows, people on those occasions send monetary gifts. He thanked them all and walked them all over to a crisis pregnancy center in Chicago.
That's remarkable, man.
Really quite remarkable. Not dressed by Brooks Brothers by any manner of means. but always full of life. And, you know, you said, you know, people would say brilliant, funny, strong. There was a unique kind of sanctity about Paul. Mm. It was a kind of desert father sanctity.
I mean,
it was a kind of, it was a bit rough hewn, perhaps, but there was, he strove for sanctity.
Yeah.
And I think under some very difficult circumstances.
Let's talk
he was
about
blessed
that.
By that.
Let's talk about why he was silenced and also the insight that he had on the abuse crisis, which he was onto fairly early compared to the Boston Globe. What was the problem? Why was he silenced?
Well, as I explained in the introduction, there was a famous article by his friend and mine, Professor James Hitchcock,
sure. mm-hmm.
of St. Louis University, a fine historian, laying out the rather sorry tale of how Father Bob Drinan first got elected to Congress, what was going on within the New England province of the Jesuits during that, and Hitchcock's article was based on materials that Paul Menkowski had gleaned from the archives of the New England province with the permission of the archivist. And this created a huge fuss, but the fuss wasn't about Drinan, the fuss was about Menkowski. So I, some years ago, 15 years ago at least, he had written a memorandum, which he shared with friends, on how this all had happened. I had that in my files somewhere. Shortly after he died, I received identical copies of the same memorandum from other friends of his.
Mm-hmm.
And I just decided this ought to be in this book. So that he got a chance finally to tell his side of the
right,
story.
Right, right.
And I hope it makes a contribution to understanding an important part of American Catholic history. But that's what really created this big, big problem for him within the society.
It demonstrates now, the dissembling that went on, and it demonstrates the clericalism that was going on there, the claim that there was no layman in Massachusetts that could run for Drinan's office was ludicrous.
Yeah, it's that's to me, as a lay Catholic and someone who's been involved in public life for 40 years,
mm-hmm.
That was the most astonishing thing in this, the claim by, I believe it was one of the provincials, that the superior General Father Ruppe should allow Father Drinan to continue in Congress because there was frankly no layman who could take his place. Well, come on. interestingly enough, as you may remember, Bob Drinan was succeeded in that seat by Barney Frank. So I doubt that Barney thought he was incapable.
Right,
of pulling
right,
Father
right.
Drinan's shoes. Paul was on to the abuse problem very early in the 90s, and I think was on to the problem, if I may call it this, the gay problem,
mm-hmm.
in certain sectors of the American clergy, particularly in religious life, long before that. And that was not a comfortable thing for others to
yeah.
hear from him.
Yeah.
But he was quite rigorous about it. And he was as critical of religious superiors and bishops who turned a blind eye or bought the nostrums of the therapeutic culture as he was of people who were acting in frankly, criminal and sinful ways.
Well, he knew.
So, it was interesting to me that this book was published just about the time in the Divine Office in the Breviary when the Jerusalemites are throwing Jeremiah down the well because they don't want to hear the truth. And there was a certain analogous business here with Paul's life and his polemic against the corruptions of clerical culture.
He was willing to say that the ends that Raymond Burke was seeking to achieve were different than the ends that Rembert Wakeman was seeking. In other words, they were not striving, though they were members of the same church, though they both had been ordained and all this, they had contradictory ends. I don't know, I mean, I've heard people say that privately in conversation, but I've never saw anybody of his stature actually be willing to lay names out like that.
Well, I mean, he encouraged a lot of us. I mean, during the synods of 2015 and 2018, I wrote more than once that a variety of German bishops simply did not believe the faith of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's right.
And I've been writing that ever since because I believe it's true. I think, you know, Paul helped me and others to see this, that what we're really not talking about style differences here.
Right.
We're talking about substantive differences and fundamentally belief differences. I mean, you either believe in the reality of divine revelation or you don't.
Exactly. Yep. God has spoken or he hasn't. Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, well... He was a great spirit, and I'm very grateful to Ignatius Press for seeing this through, and I hope your listeners and his friends enjoy revisiting this extraordinary personality through his written work. I can't remember whether I talked to Mankowski about this. When some bishop got up at the 2015 synod and said, why can't we go back to Moses and just allow husbands to give rescripts of divorce? Your Excellency, this is Team Jesus.
Well, I greatly appreciate your work in making this available to us, George, and we'll talk again. Thanks.
Thanks, Al.
This is a book called Jesuit at Large. Of course, this is still we're still in the Jesuit year here, 500 years since a cannonball fired at the Battle of Pamplona blasted Ignatius of Loyola's leg off, in which eventually led to his conversion and led to the Jesuit order. Again, the book is called Jesuit at Large, Essays and Reviews by Paul Mankowski, edited with an introduction by George Weigel. I'm Al Cresta. Well, thanks so much for being with me today, and let me remind you that you can follow up on any of our guests and their comments by going to AveMariaRadio.net. Look to the right-hand side of the homepage, see my face there, hit it, and you go to the Cresta Guest Archives for more information, all the articles that we use in preparation for the interviews. Also, books that we mention on this program, like Jesuit at Large, Essays and Reviews by Paul Mankowski, SJ, available in the online bookstore. So head on over there, AveMariaRadio.net.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for joining me. Today, in this hour, we're going to be focusing in on some very unusual passages of Scripture, but we're also going to focus in on one of the major divine institutions of the Old Covenant, but which takes unusual shape in the New Covenant, and that is the Temple. Remember Jesus' words as he passes by the temple. He says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will rebuild it. He's talking about the temple of his body, John tells us there, a little parenthetical remark. But what is the relationship between the incarnate Word of God and the actual temple that was built according to the pattern that God had given to the, originally, of course, under Solomon, but also in the rebuilding of the temple? We're going to look with Dr. Stephen Smith at, you might call it, a temple theology. What's interesting is that in Western Christianity, a lot of attention has been paid to the Jewish synagogue idea, especially in Protestant Christianity, because you've got the synagogue as the place where, you know, you get the Bible reading and then you get the teaching, kind of sermonizing. But Catholics have always thought there was something missing there. And as New Testament studies have grown up over the last 150 years, indeed, there's been a new recovery or discovery of the role that the temple plays in the spiritual imagination of the members of the Old Covenant, but also under the New Covenant. And, of course, the temple is directly tied to the incarnate Son of God himself. So we're going to see how it is that God reveals himself through the temple. A temple is the place where the priesthood works its way out, right, and does the work of sacrifice. It's the place where the covenant finds reestablishment and where the stipulations of the covenant get repeated. Stephen Smith will be my guest, and we will look over this idea of God revealing himself in the Old and New Covenants through the idea of the temple. So stay with me. Right now, though, we've got some headlines. Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. In preparation for a talk I gave at the Defending the Faith Conference this year in Steubenville, I spent a lot of time in the letter to the Hebrews, and in fact, I also realized what E.P. Sanders, the great New Testament scholar, once wrote, that it's almost impossible to make too much of the temple in first century Jewish Palestine. My guest is the man who I think has done extraordinary work in helping Catholics recover this sense of God's temple presence. And Dr. Stephen Smith is a nationally known, recognized speaker. He's author of The House of the Lord, A Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence in the Old and New Testament. He's chair and professor of biblical exegesis at the University of St. Mary of the Lake and Mundelein Seminary in Illinois. Previously, he taught scripture at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland, which is where I actually first contacted Stephen. Stephen, good to have you with me again. Thanks.
Al, it's great to be with you and all of your audience. Thanks for having me so much.
Let's go to this statement of E.P. Sanders, that it's almost impossible to make too much of the temple in first century Jewish Palestine.
I remember reading that book like you. When you mentioned that quote, I chuckled because it's actually on page 8 of the introduction. And here's the exact quote. He says, "I think it is almost impossible to make too much of the temple in the first century Jewish Palestine." He goes on to say, "Modern people think of religion without sacrifice, but they fail to see how novel that idea is." And that came from a book he wrote in the early 80s, I want to say, or early 90s, I want to say 94, 93, mm-hmm. called The Historical Figure of Jesus. And I remember reading it, and like you, it just struck me as quite a statement.
It really, and I have to confess, it's something I still strive to understand and mm-hmm. feel that temple presence more clearly. Are Catholics actually better situated to grasp this idea of the temple, the significance of the temple mm-hmm. in our worship than most Protestants?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think so, but they maybe don't always know how to articulate it.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? As I talk with lifelong Catholics, one of the big differences I still see, even with all the advances that we have, and you know, we've got, you know, Word on Fire and YouTube and all these media resources and Scott Hahn, and these are wonderful things, but I still find that just the rank and file Catholic going to Mass on Sunday loves the Lord, loves the Eucharist, and loves the Bible. But putting all those things together sometimes is a little difficult to sometimes articulate it. But I do think, because this book that I wrote and is really very liturgically oriented, and it begins with the temple theme all the way back in creation, and it moves, of course, through the law and the prophets and the rest of the Old Testament into the new, where really the high point of the book is, you know, John's proclamation that Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body, and moving on into Revelation. So it certainly is there for all to see, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, all. I do think we're well positioned, but as I said, I think we can use a little bit of help, and that's kind of why I wrote this book.
Indeed. Let's. When most people think of the temple, they think Solomon's temple, and then they think of the rebuilding of the temple and the period of time that Jesus lived, sometimes called Second Temple Judaism. But you make the point that really this side, the reality of God's temple presence goes all the way back to creation. And most people would say, I look at the Garden of Eden, I don't see any structure there called the temple. So take us back to the garden and how that is, the temple presence in the garden.
And as I do, I've got to give credit, speaking of our Reformed and Protestant brothers and sisters, I've got to give credit not only to Sanders, but to a few others as I answer this for you. It's not to say that, you know, it was reading a few of the really more erudite Protestant academics that really led me to, you know, to this topic and to this book. So Sanders is one. Another is a guy, some may know this name, Greg Beale.
Sure.
Or G.K. Beale. And he wrote a book called The Temple and the Church's Mission, A Biblical Theology of the Dwelling Place of God. It's a very good book, but with respect to Beale, who I know a little bit, John Bergsma and I laughed when my book came out. He said, I'm really glad, because I felt like it was the Catholic response to what was there and was wonderful, but maybe it was missing some things.
Yeah.
So what we start with what's in common. I think both someone like Beale and myself recognize that there is this sometimes very visible, sometimes it's a little bit more subtle theme going all the way back, yes, to creation and then tracing through the scripture. But then, as I said, you know, I think there's more from a Catholic perspective to fill in here, the sacraments, the Eucharist, and more. But to get to your question, no, I mean, I think it's not necessarily obvious, especially for, you know, modern English readers that are just looking at the Bible and seeing, okay, we have the 6 days of creation. You know, how is that in any way about the temple? Doesn't that come later with Moses? And the answer is sort of like, well, it does in some sense. You have that, you know, tabernacle and the instructions in the book of Exodus. And then from there, you know, you eventually get the temple of Solomon and so on. But if you actually look more carefully, there are a number of clues that really strike you as strange when you read the Old Testament. And I actually want to begin with a quote for you and your audience from the book of Ezekiel.
Sure.
By way of explaining Genesis, there's a passage in Ezekiel 28, where the prophet says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Now, a little bit of context here. We're obviously in a prophetic book, not the law, and Ezekiel's actually addressing the king of Tyre and Sidon, but that's not really the point. The point is that he's dressing this man up like Adam, but in the process of his sort of praise of this pagan king, in a sense, he goes on to say, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, and he names topaz and diamonds and all that. But then he says this, you are an anointed garden cherubim. I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God.
Hmm.
And that strikes you as odd, right? Because we tend to think of the geography of Eden as very, very flat. We think of, you know, sometimes the caricature of a nude man and woman with an apple in front of a two-dimensional tree, kind of almost a cartoonish picture.
Right,
of course,
that's
not the biblical vision. The vision is glorious and awesome. And what I think Ezekiel is hinting at here is there's more to that topography than meets the eye. But it's not simply one stray verse in Ezekiel. When you go back to Genesis 1 and 2 alone, there are a number of clues. One that, again, wouldn't be necessarily obvious for many English readers is the very name of God that's used in Genesis. Catholics will know the term El Shaddai, right? It was one of these many Hebrew terms. But it really means something like the God of the mountain, El, the God of the mountain. And that's kind of interesting when you put that together with Ezekiel there. And so when you actually begin to study the topography, you know, see if four rivers flowing out of Eden, well, you know, rivers tend to flow and follow the gravity and go southward or outward.
Right.
And so you get this vision then eventually when you put it all together of something much more three-dimensional, something glorious and majestic that I and a lot of other scholars have identified here as Mount Eden. And that would be maybe the starting place to see not simply a flat garden, but really a majestic vista with a garden and then, I should say, a mountain and then a garden in or on that mountain. And what you eventually get at when you put it all together, the image of Adam as a priestly figure, which comes in chapter 2, and some of this topography, is you get this image of a kind of a primordial or cosmic temple. So on the mountain is a holy of holies, that's the garden. And then you get eventually this image of Adam as a royal and priestly figure who's called to tend to that sanctuary. So, and then it kind of just builds from there.
Huh. So the Adam, so tell me then the dominion mandate that Adam receives.
So
how does that relate to his priesthood?
Sure. So, I mean, we're told that God places Adam in the garden, and he's taken out of the ground, right? He's made from the dust of the earth, and mm-hmm. to the dust he shall return. But as he places him in the garden, one of the things, you know, the first commandment that we get in the Bible, many Catholics will know this, is, of course, because it's so endemic and so important in our right to life and in just the whole pro-life movement, is be fruitful and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to associate that with this gift of natural life, and indeed it is. But I've also begun to see much more in that first commandment to be fruitful and multiply, because if you finish it off and it says, and fill the earth. Okay, so here, so let's just pause and think about it. Here's this man, Adam, who's called in a royal and kingly and priestly way to be the governor and high priest of God's garden and to order it and to perfect it. Even the naming of the animals and all that, as we know, shows his kind of royal stewardship. He's a co-regent with God, as mm-hmm. he's sometimes called. Mm-hmm. But he's also a priestly figure. What do priests do? Priests offer sacrifice to God. That's what makes them different than just pastors or, you know, reverends is priests offer sacrifice.
Right.
And so my good friend, some will know, Michael Barber, has often made the case, if you move a couple chapters over to chapter 3, that one of the ways that Adam is being portrayed is sort of as a delinquent priest, in the sense that he's in the garden, he's called to steward it, he's called to have union with Eve, his wife, the woman, and yet when the serpent comes in from outside the garden, this great threat, something more like a dragon or a leviathan, than a little garter snake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, where is he?
Right.
And actually, it's interesting. If you look at some of the older Jewish texts that come out of Rabbinic Judaism, like a book called the Book of Jubilees, written just before the time of Christ, it actually fills in the cracks and says, you know, Adam, you were delinquent. You were off when you should have been there and defending your wife and laying down your wife. Okay, laying down your life for your wife at this threat. And so what Barber does is he says, this is an image of a priest who is not focused. He's not sacrificial. He's not self-sacrificial. He's not willing to lay down his life. He's not willing to engage the threat. And indeed, it is ambiguous. When the conversation happens, right, between the serpent and the woman, he doesn't speak initially. And
right.
So he's very silent. But some early Jews, as I said, even made the argument that he was in another part of the garden. But the big picture then is that sort of he is cast out along with Eve out of the garden. So the one who's called to protect it is cast out. And what's interesting then is to go back to that statement, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, is the idea that this high priest of the garden would then not only sanctify the garden, but as Lumen Gentium says, to consecrate the world, right? And so his call ultimately is to go out into the world to be a missionary. Unfortunately, he gets off to a bad start because he's sort of booted out of the garden rather than going off with a crusader flag over his head.
Right, you know,
he goes out in humility and in sinfulness, and now very aware of his mortality with Eve, and then it goes from there. But there's much more here than obviously we can fill in a short conversation.
Sure.
But in the chapters on Genesis, I lay out some of the Hebrew terms. I'll just give you one more. In Genesis 2:15, Adam is said to serve and protect or till the soil and all of this stuff. Till and keep the land is how it sometimes come out in the translation. But that's a very poor translation in those terms, avad and shamar, to till and to work, are really priestly terms.
I'll tell you what, hold it there, Stephen. We'll come right back. afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I'm with Dr. Stephen Smith, author of The House of the Lord, a Catholic biblical theology of God's temple presence in the Old and New Testaments. First segment, we were taking a look at God's temple presence in the garden, and Adam as high priest, and we're talking about Adam's delinquency as priest, and then at the close of the last segment, we're talking about some of the language that's used to describe Adam's task at tilling the soil, and I'll let you pick it up from there again, Stephen, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so it's really interesting, and a number of scholars, Gordon Wenham is a great Old Testament scholar, has pointed this out in his commentary, The Word Biblical, and others have. Beale talks about it, I talk about it, John Bergsman does, so it's definitely, the evidence is strong. But yeah, we're talking about this verse in Genesis 2, where we often get the sense that Adam is sort of a horticulturalist, he's just a gardener,
right.
And he's called to till and keep the land, but then under those are these very interesting Hebrew words. I'll spell them out for those that, you know, most don't know Hebrew, but avad, spelled A-B-A-D, and shamar, S-H-A-M-A-R. And what's interesting, Al, is those two words, as I was saying before the break, really come out of liturgical language, out of the book of Leviticus, talking about the roles of the priest in the temple.
Wow.
And it's interesting, is we actually did a study, and of the vast number of occurrences of those words, the majority of the time when they occur within just about 10 words of one another, they always refer to this priestly vocation, this priestly activity. And there's more priestly hints as well as you move throughout the Old Testament. But I think this is something, to go back to our earlier conversation, that, you know, we as Catholics understand the role of the priesthood, both the ordained priesthood and also the priesthood of the baptized. And I think this has been maybe a blind spot for some Protestants to not seeing this temple theme. In fact, when I get to the New Testament, Al, I explained to the readers that in the 20th century, there was really a degradation of the whole idea of Jesus as a priestly figure.
Hmm.
It kind of is, especially in Protestant circles, you see this in the kind of critical circles. He's not really a priestly figure, and certainly his apostles are not. Well,
right.
Where does that come from? And I do think, not to get into the philosophical too much, but I do think in the rationalism of the 19th century, there was this movement away from high church and liturgy and, you know, kind of the Catholic sacramental view. And so in some of the German Protestant liberalism, you get this sort of, you know, movement away from any of the priestly motifs in the Old and the New Testament. But fortunately, that's changing, you know. And just in the last 20 years, well, there was Beale's book, which is a wonderful book. I'm also thinking of a guy in Illinois here at Trinity University, wonderful evangelical scholar whose name is Nick Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N. And he wrote a book called Jesus the Temple. And he wrote another one called Jesus the Priest. And it's just remarkable. I've shared this with some of my Catholic seminarians. And when I read the quotes, they're like, well, you know, who is this? Is some thesis in Rome or something? He says, no, this is an evangelical scholar. But he's willing to look at the evidence and say, you know, in the Bible, we begin to see these things, and you can't really, why deny them? Why deny them? They might be hidden for some, but for those that really study the Bible, they're pretty clear and evident once you have the proper tools to see them.
So, I mean, this is recovery of the significance of the temple, the significance of the priesthood in the life of Jesus that's occurring in, evangelical Protestant circles. Do you see, and I realize this is a little bit off our theme, but I'm curious.
Sure.
Do you see that those who are working in this field, you mentioned Nicholas Perrin, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Jesus the priest, and is there any, do they begin to think sacramentally as a result of these realizations?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm not sure. If I can be very honest, I thought quite a bit about this, is I think there's sort of an awakening and an opening and a movement there in certain circles in Protestantism that is open to it, but I'm not quite sure that, you know, in his case or in others, that they're going to cross the Tiber anytime soon.
Yeah.
I certainly think, though, that in many ways, what they're really doing is providing sort of an in-house critique to other Protestants to say, look, these are some of the things that we missed. And, you know, just to fill in the cracks in it, you can go all the way back to someone like Wellhausen, who had this, you know, four-source theory of the Pentateuch. And without getting into the weeds on that, you know, these four sources that he had, the Yahwist and the Elohist mm-hmm. and the Deuteronomist and the priestly source. What's interesting, and I talk about this in the book, is he really lamented, Al, the fact that this, what he saw as the priestly source was all of that sacrificial stuff, right, that's in the Pentateuch, especially Leviticus, but other places too. Anything that smacked of priesthood and yeah. sacrifice and the burnt offering, he assigned to that latter view. But what he believed was that was a degradation of an earlier, more pristine Israelite religion. And what he saw is that more Israelite religion kind of looked more like Protestantism, right? In the sense that it was sort of like, you know, love thy neighbor and, you know, sort of Bible and, you know, good yep. things, but sort of the moral law, but nothing that moved towards the sacramental economy.
Yeah.
And so that's in the background of the 19th century. And then that kind of floods into the 20th century and moves from the old to the new. So it's not a surprise that, you know, someone like Perrin and even Beale, they're sort of in the minority because they've been educated in sort of that whole movement to kind
right.
of not really see these things.
Yeah.
So I think it's a net plus, though.
Yeah. No. Very good. So back then to Adam, if I understand you correctly, Adam's purpose was to, in some way, had the fall not occurred, would have been to extend God's temple presence through further and further out through creation. Is that right?
I think that's it. I think that's the basic idea. I wouldn't go too much further than that and take it too literally. And then I should say, to complicate matters a little bit, is that I do think that there's a kind of a dialogue going on between, let's say, these early books like Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, the Pentateuch on one hand, and then those books that deal more substantially with the temple. So they're like the story of it in Kings, 2 Samuel, David's story, but also the Psalms, which really are the, you know, are the songbook of the temple, huh? And so, you know, some have said that, you know, the way that you would have experienced the Temple of Solomon, or even the temple that Jesus would have entered into in Herod's temple, you would have been reminded of creation. So there's a sense in which the temple is, to use catechism language, a sort of recapitulation, a kind of a perfecting, a renewing, a transforming of the creation. And I do think that is a healthy way to look at it, because if you really think about what the whole movement towards the Holy Land was worship, right? And that's the
right.
aim of creation, is Sabbath. And so when you come into the more refined later period with the temple and the sacrifices and all the festivals, in some sense, it's kind of a going back to that original mandate, right? To be fruitful and multiply, to worship God in a self-sacrificial way and in a priestly way. And we're all called to this, right? Even mm-hmm. today as Catholics, we're called to live out that same mandate from Eden.
Yeah. It is very true that often when people talk about the story of the Exodus, it's, you know, Moses liberating the Hebrews from bondage in Pharaoh's Egypt, and there's the great story of let my people go. But what's often dropped is the purpose of letting those people go, that they might go and worship God.
Indeed.
That was the purpose Indeed. Of the Exodus, was worship, not just liberation Indeed. In the abstract.
That's true. So, very true.
You mentioned...
You know, it's interesting.
No,
go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was
just going to say you... Yeah.
No, go right ahead.
I was thinking, pondering your question about the, you know, these scholars like Perrin and others, and what do they make of this? And I just had one additional thought, and that is, I don't know what the average Protestant person does with the following verse, which takes us into the New Testament, of course. But in John chapter 2, in that scene, you know, that we were referring to, John says in John 2:21, but Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body. And I don't know how you can really, well, first of all, you can't really make sense of what that means until you first know a little bit about temple theology. You know, so the temple is the dwelling place of God. So here is the divinity in person, but also it's the place where sacrifice is offered, so sacrifice of his own body. And, you know, I think they might connect it to Calvary, to the cross, but I think that's where it would stop, unfortunately.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's they kind of, it really weakens the imagery. You go back to, you quote from 1 Chronicles 5:13-14, And I'll just say it. It was the duty of the trumpeters and singers to make themselves heard in unison in praise and thanksgiving to the Lord. And when the song was raised with trumpets and cymbals and other musical instruments in praise to the Lord, quote, "For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever," the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. So often when people think of temple, they think of ritual, they think of liturgy, but they don't necessarily think of this kind of dynamic presence of God with his right. people, of which, of course, Jesus is the most vivid example of him with his people. But I don't think that connection between Jesus, the temple of his body, and this remarkable kind of explosion of God's presence in the temple, I don't think those things are connected in the normal reading of John chapter 2 there. So, yeah.
Yeah, and especially for Catholics, Al. I mean, the subtitle of this book is A Catholic Biblical
right.
Theology of God's Temple Presence. And so I'm hoping that many Catholics will pick this up and give it a go. It's not a dense or difficult read.
No, it's not.
I think you've got a college degree, but it certainly will engage you. But, I mean, I think, I would say don't get lost in the details of these, Hebrew words. And, you can take what you want from us. But read it for the narrative that I'm laying out and saying, what if it is the case that from the very beginning of the Bible to the very end, God has kind of painted a picture of what worship is intended to be? And that begins in the very opening words of the creation story, and it goes all the way to the end of Revelation. And in the sense, in the bullseye there, of course, in the very center are the Gospels. But you mentioned Hebrews. It's certainly there are traces of it in the latter New Testament books. There's traces of it in the wisdom books of the Old Testament. As it turns out, I'm teaching a course on the wisdom books.
Yeah.
And some of my seminarians who love the scriptures have, they've never read some of these books like Sirach. And we came to the last chapter of Sirach, chapter 50. And it's an encomium to the priest of Sirach's day. And I recommend any who are listening who are priests or deacons or studying or just know a priest or just love the priesthood to read that chapter, Sirach chapter 50, and what you see is a glorious depiction of the role of the priest, especially in our day when people are questioning the relevance of, the priesthood and of the Catholic Church and, the abuse scandal and all these other things, to remind ourselves of God's vision of priesthood.
Very good. Stephen, hold it there. We'll come back. My guest, Dr. Stephen Smith, The House of the Lord, A Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence in the Old and New Testaments. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Stephen Smith. He's the author of The House of the Lord, A Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence in the Old and New Testaments. We started back in the Garden of Eden because I think for many people, that's the place where they would least think there's, quote, temple theology. But we also we've spent some time talking, of course, in the Mosaic Law, talking about the Solomonic Temple. And I wanted, Stephen, for you to pick up on this theme of the glory cloud, this idea that in the tabernacle you have the presence of the Shekinah glory, but in the temple you also have this glory of God that is almost sensible. It's that tangible. What is this theme of the glory cloud, and where does it emerge finally in under the New Covenant?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So this Shekinah is this mysterious cloud, and we see it in some sense over Sinai when Moses goes up in the cloud. It's, you might say, it's this veil between mortal man and the deity, right? So that, I mean, we know that a few different places in the Old Testament that God says, "You cannot see my face and live." I'm thinking especially of Exodus 33, where Moses begs, "Pray, show me your glory." And I think there are a couple different ways that it comes into the New Testament. We'll get into that in a moment. But I think the idea of this is we're losing this in some ways in our culture, this notion of mystery, this notion of the transcendent nature of God. I mean, I think one of the things that, that our Protestant brothers and sisters do well is talk about Jesus is friend, and indeed he is our friend with a capital F. He is our friend. But you know, the biblical vision of the triune God from, you know, from Elohim in the Old Testament all the way through the New Testament, in the person of Jesus and the Holy Spirit, is a much more mysterious thing. And, you know, in the chapter, I devote a whole chapter to Leviticus, I describe in great detail the preparation that the high priest had to make before going into what's called the Kodesh Kodeshim, or the Holy of Holies, to prepare for that awesome encounter. You don't just waltz into the temple.
Right.
And so in that chapter, talk about, you know, it may sound strange, even a little bit off-putting to us, but, you know, the high priest would stay awake for 7 nights prior to that. I can imagine doing that, what kind of, you know, energy drinks he had. But the idea would be to not even have, what, to put it politely, a nocturnal emission, right? Even an accidental emission, you know, so from his body, so that he would not in any way bring impurity before the Lord. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, the modern person says, this is so much nonsense. I mean, can't we just relate and pray to God? And why is there all of this fear of God? And I think that really misses the mark. It's, you see in the ancient Jewish tradition, this holy reverence for that Shekinah, that place where God himself dwells. And of course, in scripture, it's twofold. It's in the heavens above, God's heavenly home, but it's also in the Holy of Holies, so that he can really be encountered in a very personal way. And so let's take that idea forward. So, okay, so the high priest prepares himself, and then what does he do? He takes, there's a sacrifice, right, a sacrificial animal, and he takes some of that blood. He goes in and very carefully, singing psalms, he sprinkles some of that blood sacrifice on what's called the mercy seat. That's over the Ark of the Covenant. And in so doing, he's atoning for his own sins and also for the sins of all of Israel. And it is true, the scripture talks about, and the rabbinic tradition talks about, a cord that would have been tied about his leg so that if God were displeased and smote him, they wouldn't have to go in. They could pull him out, you know, in one fell swoop, which tells you how seriously all of this was taken.
Yes.
But then you come into, you know, the New Testament, and you see, you know, in Matthew's gospel, right, after the crucifixion, that that massive veil, huge, heavy, high purple veil, adorned with jewels, was torn in two, right? So it's exposing that holy place that was so revered all the way through Jewish tradition. And I think the evangelist is telling us there's something remarkable Christologically about who Jesus is. He's the one who is the very presence of God, but also allows us that access, right? Come unto me, all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. And then that's picked up also in the book of Hebrews as well. There's a Marian connection here too, because in the book of Exodus, there's this this word that's used to describe the glory cloud in Exodus chapter 40. So just a little bit of context. Exodus chapter 20 through 24 is the giving of the law, and then Exodus chapter 25 through 40 is where everyone falls asleep. No, it's not true, but it is difficult because you get all these painstaking instructions in from God to Aaron and Moses in terms of constructing the tabernacle and all of the vestments and everything else for the tent of meeting. But then at the very end of it, in Exodus 40:34, we read, then the cloud, this is that Shekinah that you're talking about, covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And this is the same word from the Septuagint of that book that is picked up in the story of Mary in the New Testament,
I
right?
Know. Yes.
The glory of the Lord is now, and the church fathers saw this, so they saw that what was being hinted at in a kind of, you know, epiphany with Moses there in a mysterious way is now being clothing the Blessed Virgin Mary as she gives birth to the Savior of the world, who is the new temple. So a kind of direct connection between both the old and the new. And then you can go on into other examples of this glory cloud, and as I said, in Hebrews, and then ultimately in Revelation, at the end of the Bible, you get this notion that it's the very heavenly temple coming down from heaven, which reveals the glory of God and gives radiance to all of humanity. No more tears, no more cancer, no more death, no more rape, no more, you know, trafficking, no more fill in the blank, and the Lord will be with his bride. So it is really a theme that moves swiftly and mysteriously through the whole of the scripture.
Jesus' phrase, something greater than the temple is here. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, you know, he makes a couple of really interesting statements there in Matthew chapter 10. And one of them is, you know, something greater than the sign of Jonah is here, right? And there's that. So the comparison to the prophets, to the prophets. But something greater than the temple is kind of a mysterious one because, again, if you see this only as a building where ancient Jews would go in and worship God, you're missing three quarters of it. You're missing the whole of it, right? Because the very idea is, as I said, with that high priest going in, you're coming into the very presence of God. And so I think his statement there is very much a Christological statement, very much a statement that the evangelists are telling us, cueing us in to the very identity of Jesus as the divine Son, as the new Adam, as the one who's to be worshipped. And so it's a very, very powerful statement. And again, it's not that Catholics don't hear these things. We hear these in the Mass. But then the question is, you know, how well are they being articulated and conveyed in homilies? Sometimes very well. Sometimes we can maybe do better.
Yeah.
And then what about beyond the liturgy? What can we do as moms and dads? What can we do as elementary school or high school teachers to help really bring this story together for the people? And just one last thing I'll say is I had a seminarian recently who's a big fan of Scott Hahn and said, you know, Dr. Smith, how does this temple theme relate to the covenant? Because
sure.
I've been taught, you know, by reading his books that's the central theme. And I said, well, I think that there's not a competition here. I think that when you look at the story of the covenant, that temple is kind of is that iconic image that accompanies the people all the way from creation, all the way, you know, through that covenantal story. As I said, the whole idea is to get to that land in the Old Testament where they can worship God. And so God's covenantal people worship, and that covenant is demonstrated through sacrifice, both old and new. So I think the two go together very much hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I agree. There's no necessary competition here. I am concerned, though, that why, what has to be done to help our people recover this sense of awe, this idea that when we gather for worship and we have the liturgy, we are participants in that liturgy, that we are, in fact, in a sense, being lifted up, calling down and being lifted up into that glory. And and I agree, the worship is meant then to extend out to the other spheres of our life, our family life, and even our work life. But how, I'm just curious, how does one go about eliciting from people that sense of awe?
I'll be honest with you, Al, I think it's got to be a prayerful activity, right? Because it's got to be multifaceted, all these things we talked about, education, school, friendships, all these things, and certainly in the church itself. But I think in some sense, and speaking especially to parents here, I think it has to begin far away from the temple, so to speak. You know, if you go back to the Psalms and you look at Psalms 120 through 33, 34, they're called the Psalms of Ascent. These were the songs, the Psalms that the Jews that lived out in the diaspora would sing on the way into Jerusalem, on the way up to the temple. You read them, and they're beautifully Jerusalem-focused. They're beautiful. They talk about the exile and God's vindication and all this stuff and the house of the Lord. But my point in that is, you know, when you're a long way off from the temple, that is to say from the parish. So let's take, how far away can you get? Monday morning, you know? My point would be here is to, I don't think we'll have as effective results or success if we just say, well, we're going to make the kids get up early, we're going to say a rosary first, we're going to dress them up nicely, we're going to really make it a special day. I'm for all of those things, by the way. But I mean, I don't think that that's in itself enough. I think it's got to be holistic. It's got to integrate, you know, whether or not they go to the Catholic school, to be asking them about what they're learning, to be trying to make connections between the things that are going on in the culture, the things that their friends are talking about, even the music that they're listening to. And that, I don't mean in an invasive way to kind of like, you know, to smother the kids, but I simply mean having a kind of dynamic relationship where they can come and talk to you. I think also even going outside, I mean, if one thing this book has taught me is that there is this kind of natural beauty back there in the book of Genesis, that the creation is a gift from God, mm-hmm. not just something that, you know, we get in our car and go to work. And you know, so getting outside, enjoying, going on hikes, spending time in silence, and then certainly all those things that one would think when it comes to parish life. I mean, I do think how we approach the liturgy, how we dress, and how much time we allocate, and are we rushing in? Do we read the scriptures beforehand? So when we're there, we're in a mental place where we've heard them, we know what's coming up. Do we have a relationship with our pastor or someone at the parish that, you know, the kids know they can talk to them? How are we praying at home? Is it go beyond grace before and after meals? And then, you know, reading the Bible. I mean, lastly, reading the Bible, reading the Jesus story, reading the scriptures, and talking about that great story, so that by the time hopefully they're 18 or 20, these kids have had a real saturation in kind of a lived temple theology. But I think it's something that we need, you know, parish and school and teacher and parents and grandparents and all these things working together.
Yeah, indeed. And it's going to take, again, us working together, innovating ways of better communicating these truths. I just think your book's tremendous, and I hope that it's getting the support and promotion that it deserves, because I think you're connecting us with the biblical, the theme throughout the biblical narrative, which has the most immediate impact on our lives, or at least our experience of worship. So, Stephen, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Al. We'll see you again. God bless you.
Let's talk soon. Dr. Stephen Smith, The House of the Lord, A Catholic Biblical Theology of God's Temple Presence in the Old and New Testaments. You really have to get a hold of this. And take your time, enjoy it, chapter by chapter, and then ask, how does this relate to my own experience and the experience of my family? How do I enter into this more deeply? Well, thanks much, and I'll be with you, Lord willing, on Monday for more of this thing we call Crest in the Afternoon. I do want to stress, though, that this, for those of you who are interested in biblical theology and are trying to come up with a truly Catholic understanding of Scripture and how the divine institutions of Scripture develop from their first disclosure in the Old Testament and their fulfillment in the New, this is one of those books you want to get your hands on. So, again, head on over to AveMariaRadio.net. That is AveMariaRadio.net, and you can pick up Stephen's book. Also, we will have there follow-up information on our conversation with George Weigel regarding the late Father Paul Mankowski and the new collection of essays that George has edited and Ignatius Press has published. The book's available in the online bookstore, but there's more information in the Cresta Guest Archives as well. So, keep each other in prayer over the weekend. I'll see you on Monday.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.